So first of all, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming along today to hear me talk about target cost contracts. So in terms of what I'm going to look at today, I'm talking about target cost contracts under the NEC suite of contracts, and in particular the engineering and construction contracts, main options C and D. And I'm going to talk about the general principles behind target cost contracts, and then look at some of the problems and issues that you can face when using them, consider how they can be resolved, with the idea being that will help you if you're using target cost contracts to get the best out of them, to use them effectively. So the talk is based around NEC contract forms, but in fairness, most of the principles I'll cover will be applicable to any type of target cost arrangement you may be working under. So the first thing, what is a target cost? How does a target cost contract work? I'll just skip straight to this slide, which indicates graphically the general principles behind target cost arrangements. So the idea is you set a target cost. That target cost can move up or down with variations, with compensation events under NEC terminology. The contractor is then paid their actual cost on a periodic basis, so normally monthly. And under NEC, we call that the defined cost, plus a fee for overheads and profit. And at the end of the project, you can compare the target cost, plus or minus any changes, to the actual cost spent by the contractor, and work out whether a saving has been made or an overspend. So you have to the left of the diagram, the example there, good news, the final actual cost, the final defined cost plus fee, is lower than the target cost. A saving's been made, and that saving is shared between the parties on a pre-agreed percentage split. Okay? Conversely, on the right-hand side, we see the negative situation. In that situation, the final prices has been exceeded by the actual cost plus fee. So there's been an overspend. And in that situation, that overspend is again shared between the parties on a pre-agreed percentage split. So the idea behind these contracts and the reason why they are being very commonly adopted, not just here in the UK, but also Far East, Middle East, elsewhere in the world, is to try and align the behaviours of the parties, trying to encourage both parties to work together to create savings. Because for every dollar saved, 50 cents on a 50-50 split goes to either party. For every dollar of overspend, that's also shared between the parties. So the parties are encouraged to be collaborative, to partner, to work together to create these savings, avoid an overspend situation. And also, because payment is made on a reimbursable basis, on a cost-plus type arrangement, this gives visibility to the employer of the contractor's actual cost. They can see what the contractor is actually spending, they can see whether they're making money or losing money. And that helps, again, engender trust. When you come to agree the cost of changes, compensation events, you can actually see what the works are costing the contractor, and that makes that process easier. It still can be challenging, but maybe easier than on the sort of rate-based arrangement. Also, because the contractor will have to demonstrate ultimately all the costs they're going to claim for payment, it helps reduce the potential for inflated claims. The contractor can't claim very easily for more than they're going to spend, because ultimately they have to prove all their costs. They have to demonstrate the costs they're claiming have been incurred on the project. So again, it helps to reduce the claims disputes on certain projects. It also can provide greater flexibility to the employer to design their project post-contract, and also can allow an earlier start on site. And interestingly as well, with target cost arrangements, they originated in civil engineering, in sort of projects where there's a lot of groundwork, so high degree of risk. And even now, they are still quite suited to projects where there is a high degree of risk, and through the pay and gain process, you can share that risk between the parties. This slide here just tries to show graphically again how the allocation of risk post-contract sits with a target cost arrangement compared to other traditional forms of reimbursement to the contractor. So you've got two sliding scales there. On the horizontal, you've got increasing contractor risk reward. On the vertical, increasing employer risk reward. And risk reward are put together because they're two sides of the same coin in effect. So if you look at the bottom right-hand side, lump sum, in that situation, the contractor is taking the greater financial risk post-contract. If they bid a project at $10 million and they build it for $9 million, they'll make $1 million profit, they get all the benefit. If they bid it at 10 million and spend 11, they lose $1 million and they take all the pain. Conversely, top left, cost reimbursable. In that situation, there's no target set, there's no cost of the works, it's a reimbursable contract. And so the employer only pays what the contractor actually spends. They spend 9 million, pay them 9. They spend 11, pay them 11. So the employer's taking all the upside and downside risk of the price being more or less than anticipated. And right in the middle, you have the target cost arrangements. And this is again why a lot of people pick target costs. It's seen as the most equitable allocation of risk post-contract. You've got a target cost of 10 million, contractor builds it for 9, the employer and the contractor will get half of the savings, half $1 million each. If it costs 11 million, both parties will pay towards that. So it's that equitable allocation of risk post-contract that drives people to adopt target cost arrangements. So in terms of setting target costs, one question I'm commonly asked is, when is the best time to set a target cost? And in fairness, there's no right answer. Some of you may well be familiar with this diagram, which is a sort of time and value curve, demonstrating that the greatest potential for savings in a project's life cycle is at the start, in the feasibility, the concept design stage. That's when the big decisions are made that will really drive the cost of the project. Whereas towards the end in the construction phase, there's a lot lower potential for savings to be made. You're looking for efficiencies on site, savings in the supply chain, logistics, those kind of issues. So the earlier you can set a target cost, the greater the potential for savings to be created and those savings to be shared by the parties. So wherever possible, I'd advise to get your target cost set earlier in the process. But there's a problem with that, in that nobody really knows what a construction contract is going to cost until it's finished. Don't have any estimators in the audience, but forgive me. The reality is that no one really knows the cost of a project until it's finished, when all the bills have been paid, the subcontract account settled. So the more you move back in time through outline design into feasibility, the less certainty you have over scope, the greater the risk potential. You'll have less site investigation, less knowledge of the materials you're going to use, the component specification. So that causes a challenge that you want to set it early, but you don't want to set it at a point where there's just too much risk, too much uncertainty. So a balance has to be struck between these two positions. What some clients do is where they know the type of work they're going to be doing, it's repetitive, maybe they've consistently done similar work before, they can set a target cost at the very early stage, possibly the end of feasibility. Particularly if they're doing a sort of a programme of work, where maybe they're doing 500 installations that are similar, they can set an average unit price for that installation and set a target cost at the very earliest stage. And then you can track savings against that, hopefully, and demonstrate some sort of gain share being delivered. But that can only work, as I say, where you've got very repetitive, consistent activities. The other alternative to deal with a situation is to have some sort of two-stage process. And this is actually akin to what HS2 and others are looking to do at the moment. So the idea here is, at the earliest stage, the contractor is engaged on some sort of cost-plus arrangement. So maybe a professional services contract, some sort of pre-construction services agreement. Well, they'll come in and they'll provide services for a period on a cost-plus basis. And hopefully, by their early involvement, early contractor engagement, you'll see savings happening in that first stage. When you've got enough certainty over scope, there's enough clarity over what you actually want to build and buy from the supply chain, you can then set your target cost, and then the target cost process, the pain gain mechanism, kicks in from that point forward. So there's two different approaches, single stage, two stage. It's this dichotomy you have of wanting to set the target cost as early as possible, but at a point where you've got some certainty over what it is you want to buy, what the supply chain has to deliver. Okay, in terms of how you set the target cost itself, there's different ways you can do this. You can go down a traditional competitive route. You can go to the market and get two or three bidders to price a target cost and give you a price. Or you can negotiate. And quite commonly in the UK at least, there's been a lot of negotiation of target costs. Other parts of the world, they tend to do more competitive tendering. But the challenge in both situations is making sure you get a target cost that is achievable and yet challenging to the contractor. Because the only way that target cost contracts are going to work effectively is if you set a challenging and robust target cost at the start. Okay, I'll try and demonstrate this on the next slide. So the idea here is you've got the middle line there, that's the outturn cost of the project. That's what the job should cost to build. In a traditional lump sum fixed priced arrangement where you've got a lot of different companies bidding for the work, you may see a situation where the tender comes in at a figure below the potential construction cost. Somebody's buying the job. They're bidding the job at a loss to win the tender. Now, I don't know how many have seen that situation, but I've been there in the past where that's happened. And on the back of that, what happens next? The contractor then has to employ a team of people to generate variations and claims, to look at every way they can increase the cost of the project to make a return, to make a profit. So it's a very negative arrangement where you've got this team of people purely there to generate claims, variations, not getting the job built any quicker, any cheaper. In fact, actually trying to make it more expensive for the employer to get that return. So we're trying to avoid that situation. And in the perfect world of the target cost is set at the right level. And on the back of that, that team of people who were there doing the variations and claims can now put all their energies and efforts into making savings. They can actually try and reduce the cost of the supply chain, efficiencies, logistics, all that good stuff. The idea being that the defined cost plus fee comes in lower, a savings made, shared between the parties. That's the perfect world. The danger you've got, particularly where target costs are negotiated, is the target cost starts off at an inflated level. That it's talked up to a figure to include lots of risk, lots of spare money in case of problems and difficulties. And then you can find that you may see a saving being made, you may see gain share being paid to the contractor, but actually the employer has not received value for money. The target costs were set at too generous or too high a figure at the start. So the aim you've got to try and get to is that middle position. And that's not easy. It's challenging to do that. And your competitive tender, you get that risk of a buying situation. Negotiation, it can be overstated. You want to get somewhere in between the two. And the options around that are maybe selective tendering, employing specialists to help challenge the contractor, get the contractor to try and pull the price together in a very open and visible way so you can see the component parts and the building blocks of their price. Okay, moving on to the ECC, so NEC 3 Engineering and Construction Contract. Interestingly, in that contract, if it's the same as any other contract, it only comes into effect when you actually sign up to it. It doesn't govern pre-contract activities, which may seem fairly obvious, but what that means is there's no guidance in the contract on how to set a target cost, over what that target cost includes. It simply starts on the premise of you have a target and we work from that point forward. So if you're going to be looking to pull together a target cost arrangement, you have to cover the mechanism of how the target cost will be set in your sort of invitation to tender type documents and outline it there. And interestingly, within the ECC again, that contract doesn't actually use the term target cost within it. It's on the cover, but that doesn't use that term within the actual contract itself. It refers to the prices. So the prices equate to the target cost under options C and D. And the difference between the two options, option C activity schedule and option D bill of quantities, is in how the risk of quantities is dealt with. So under option C, the risk of quantities is shared between the parties as part of the pain share gain share mechanism. Under option D, the contract is subject to remeasure. So the target cost is actually remeasured to reflect the actual quantities of work done. So under option D, it's the employer who is taking the risk of quantities, both positive and negative, but it's different risk allocation around quantities between those two main options. Okay, in both of those situations, the starting point has to be, what are the component parts? What are the building blocks that make up a target cost? And there's no definition I'm aware of. I've got a sort of working definition I use, which is a target cost is a genuine pre-estimate of the most likely outturn cost for the project as defined in the contract documentation. So basically, it's the price for the works as specified in the contract. And the key thing here is if you're a contractor bidding for work under a target cost contract, the amounts you should allow in that target cost are the same amounts you would allow under any fixed price contract. It's all the same things. It's basically the cost to the contractor of building the works as laid out in the contract based on the balance of risk within those documentations. And there's three key elements to the target: the base cost, the fee, and an allowance for the contractor's risk under the contract. Just going to look at those elements in more detail now. So when you're building up your target cost, you can look first of all at the defined cost, the actual cost of construction, what I refer to as the base cost. And within that, you're going to get labour. So that's cost of people under NEC terminology. So the people actually go out and dig the holes on site. You've then got plant, which again under NEC terminology is called equipment. So this is temporary works contractor's plant. Anything used to provide the works that's not incorporated therein. On top of that, you've got materials for incorporation into the works. You then have subcontracts. And in reality, I think this diagram's a little bit out of kilter. That subcontract section will probably be the greatest part of your base cost, but it's still a component part. And then you have staff. So the actual management costs to the contractor, which again, NEC terminology, are referred to as people. And all of those elements together comprise the base cost. So in NEC terminology, the defined cost, the direct costs of construction. In addition to that, within the target cost, the contractor allow money for their risk. So the risk that they're allocated under the contract, the things that they will not be compensated for if they occur, the risks that have been apportioned and attached to the contractor. And on top of all that, you would add in a fee percentage to cover primarily for the contractor's overheads and profit. And all of that together becomes the target cost, NEC terminology, the total of the prices. Okay, so that's your target cost. And the interesting thing to note here is that once that target cost is set, it becomes a bottom line value. Okay, you don't actually split it out into individual elements when you're comparing it for the pain gain. The target cost becomes a bottom line value against which you then compare the contractor's actual cost. So each month, NEC speak, the contractor claims their defined cost plus fee. That builds up month on month. And at the end of the project, you compare the defined cost plus fee to the target. And in this example, good news, it's less. A saving's been made. That saving can be shared between the parties. Okay, so coming back to the defined cost and what's in that, I've outlined it's basically labour, plant, material, subcontracts. So it's all the direct costs of undertaking the work. So it's temporary works, it's all your prelims, method-related charges. All of those costs have to be in with that base cost. It's the direct cost of construction. And the idea is this price should be created net of risk. Or if there are risk allowances within it, they should be identified to avoid there being a double counting of risk later when you make an allowance for the contractor's risk as a separate line item. You then have the fee percentage. As I mentioned already, this primarily covers for the contractor's overheads and profit and the cost of insurances. Okay? And again, it's very important for a contractor, if they are bidding for a target cost under an NEC arrangement, that they understand what will be covered by the fee and what will be covered by the direct cost or the defined cost plus fee. Because very often contractors can be caught out here by assuming that certain things will be chargeable at cost when actually under this contract they're deemed to be in the fee. A classic example being the cost of management off-site. That needs to be in with the cost of the fee as opposed to a direct cost of construction. So if you're a contractor bidding, it's very important to understand how costs are apportioned between these two elements. The next thing we have is the contractor's risk, okay? And even though it's termed the contractor's risk, because it forms part of the target cost, it is therefore shared between the parties. So if a risk allowance is made and not required, that saving will go into the pain share, gain share calculation. In the same way, if an allowance is made for a risk and it's insufficient, that overspend against that item will again go into the pain share, gain share calculation. So whilst it's risk that the contractor carries, the effect of it is shared through the pain gain mechanism. And the key thing to understand here is that the items allowed for within the target for the contractor's risk are items for which they wouldn't be compensated, for which there wouldn't be a variation granted under other contract forms. So the idea being you have your target price, you would then separately have your employer's risk reserve, the employer's contingency. So the amount of money reserved for the events at the employer's risk, so changes in scope, etc. And then as and when an employer's risk event occurs, a variation's instructed, money moves from the employer's risk pot across into the target cost. You wouldn't believe how long it took me to get that thing to move across like that on that slide. It took hours. But that's how it should work. You add the risk into the target cost is increased. So they're the basic principles behind setting a target cost. And as I've said, for me, coming back to the point of the talk and getting effective target cost contracts, to get that set at the right level is your greatest challenge. If you set it at the right level, everything from that point on gets a lot easier because you've got a challenging target for the contractor to try and achieve. So target costs in place, you're now into the post-contract stage. The next key thing is maintaining the target cost. And what I mean by this is making sure the target cost is altered to reflect change, to reflect under any C terminology, compensation events, variations as you may know them. So the idea is this target cost will move when employers' risk events, when variations, compensation events occur. And it's essential that you assess and deal with these in a timely manner. And the way you assess these compensation events should be in the same way in which the target cost was set. So the idea being you've got your target made out of defined cost plus risk plus fee. You then get a compensation event and it's priced in the same way. You work out, because of this varied piece of work, what additional labour do I need, plant, materials, subcontracts, plus an allowance for risk, plus the fee. And all of that gets added together to become the compensation event value. So it's very much like this mini target cost when you set each compensation event. It's the same building blocks that come together. Okay? And as I've already mentioned, for me, the second sort of big lesson around target cost contracts is to deal with change in a timely fashion. Agree the effective change as and when it occurs. The idea of having a target cost is to incentivize the contractor to beat a number. But if you put that number to one side and don't update it with changes, with variations, it becomes devoid from reality. It doesn't reflect the scope of work. So suddenly, the contractor doesn't have a figure they're trying to beat. The target loses its meaning. And unfortunately, what I've seen in a lot of situations is people actually abandoning the target cost and defaulting to a cost reimbursable arrangement because they've not managed change. They've not maintained the target. So for me, the second sort of big lesson is to make sure you do maintain that target. You agree change as and when it occurs. So in terms of target cost then, we've set the target, we're maintaining that target through changes. The next element is defined cost. So the actual payment of the contractor of the cost they incur in building the project. So under the NEC-ECC contract, options C and D, there is a definition of defined cost. And again, it's really important to understand that even though this is a cost reimbursable contract, there is a very definitive set of rules within the contract over what constitutes cost as opposed to what's in the fee. So under this contract, defined cost is the amount due to subcontractors for work which is subcontracted, and the cost of components in accordance with the schedule of cost components, so a further set of rules, less any disallowed cost. So looking at these in turn, the subcontracted cost element is fairly straightforward. It's direct costs. So whatever the contractor pays to their subcontractors, they will claim for the employer for payment on a back-to-back basis. In terms of the contractor's other costs, if you like the direct cost, the cost they incur out with subcontractors, that's recovered in accordance with the schedule of cost components. So the building blocks we have there are people, equipment, plant and materials, charges, manufacturing, fabrication, design and insurance. So these sections give rules on what costs can be claimed. So people is basically the direct cost to the contractor of employing staff and labour. So whatever they pay their staff, they claim from the employer. Whatever they pay their labour, again, they claim back to back. Equipment, NEC terminology for contractors, plant and temporary works, and again, claimed back to back. If they hire pieces of equipment in, the higher cost is passed to the employer. If they buy it, then a depreciation cost is passed to the employer. Item 3, plant and materials, straightforward pass-through. What the contractor pays for the purchase of materials, they claim from the employer on a back-to-back invoice basis. Item 4, charges, incorporates a number of elements, but primarily it's charges and bills received, so utilities for the site, renting land, those sorts of items. Items 5 and 6 relate to costs incurred outside of the site itself. They relate to manufacturing, fabrication or design work that takes place outside of the site. And there's a set of rules within those sections that govern how the contractor is paid for those costs. And it's on the basis of a pre-agreed schedule of rates for the workers involved in undertaking those activities. The final item, insurance, is actually an element deducted from the contractor's cost. In the contract requires the contractor to insure for certain eventualities. If the eventuality occurs, so job's halfway through, it burns down, the contractor should claim on their insurance the cost of rebuilding it to that same point, rather than charge the employer for it twice. Okay. So in terms of defined cost, it's very important to have some sort of verification process in place. Obviously, the employer needs to understand what is being claimed and how it's being claimed. And the normal way to evidence that is for the contractor to give open access to their accounts and records and give the employer or their team a chance to come in and audit them. A sample audit approach used to be quite common, so a 10% sample of the cost being claimed. But what we're seeing now is a lot more forensic audits taking place using computer-based systems to interrogate 100% of the costs, looking for repeats, stray items, etc. And that can be quite a powerful tool for making sure the costs are valid. But for me, the biggest thing about verification is not that, yeah, here's a bill, they've paid this bill. It's about value for money tests. Because if they may be able to prove that they're paying, you know, they've paid for a subcontractor to come in and move a fence post, but if they're paying £1 million for that subcontractor moving a single fence post, yeah, they've paid it, but hang on a minute, is that value for money? So not just checking that costs have been incurred, you need to check that you're getting value for money if you're on the employer's team. And the way the NEC deals with this issue, it requires that all amounts claimed as defined cost are incurred at open market or competitively tendered prices. So the contractor has to show that they've been out to the market and got some competitive quotes to prove what they're claiming is value, or they can benchmark it to the market and say, yeah, this is the cheapest way of purchasing this particular item. The only thing to be mindful of there, in fairness, is that there's that quality value sort of, or quality price type calculation. And it may be the contractor is paying more for an item, but it's because it's better quality. Maybe it's a piece of equipment that's more reliable, higher outputs, better productivity. So you may need to have a bit more of an involved discussion when you're auditing, not just it's the lowest price, but is it the best value for money? But ultimately, that value for money requirement should be driven by the target cost. If you've got a challenging target, the contractor should want to pick the lowest cost subcontractor, want to buy the lowest cost materials, because they'll make gain share and avoid pain. So ultimately, that's the greatest driver for these value for money type tests. Okay, final thing to talk about under the defined cost is disallowed cost. Now, these are costs which the contractor may well have incurred,